Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 7th. I'm Ray Graff. Well, it's almost tax time, and on today's program, we get some year-end tax advice from two folks at BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty are here. If you have a tax question, call now. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551, or email us voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Taxes today. This is the only show of the year that our CFO, Jordan Yuxall, actually likes. So this is exciting stuff. Judy Cahey, Dawn Doherty, and your tax questions coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On today's program, we'll get some tax tips from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Judy Cahey has decades of tax experience and extensive knowledge in the areas of individual, corporate, partnership, and estate and trust taxation. Judy has a bachelor's in accounting from Castleton State College and a master's in taxation from UAlbany. Dawn Doherty is a certified public accountant and tax partner at BST. She has over 35 years accounting and tax experience, providing consultation, planning, compliance, and tax accounting services, in addition to tax controversy services. What's tax controversy services? Is that a typo or is that a real thing? We'll find out in a minute.
Right.
If you guys have a question out there, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We welcome these two back a couple of times a year, and this is a good time to get some year-end tax ideas. And if you have a question, 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. Judy and Dawn, welcome back.
Hey, Ray.
Thanks for having us.
So again, I'm sure I asked you this last time. What's a tax controversy service?
Generally speaking, it's handling tax audits.
Oh, okay.
For our clients.
That's the official term.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a controversy.
It is.
Now, you work for the IRS. Does the IRS consider it controversy or...
No, they consider it part of good tax administration.
Fair enough. We heard in the news talk of inflation and how that's affecting spending at the end of the year. But I know there are some adjustments. I don't know what they mean, but I know there have been some inflation adjustments for 2023. If you could just both tell me a little bit about what we can expect.
So on the individual side, when you file your return, you either itemize or you claim the standard deduction, depending on which is higher.
Right.
So with all the inflation happening, we're seeing increases in the limit. So for example, as people gear up to file their 2023 return, when they file their standard deduction will be $1,800 more than it was last year. If they're married filing joint, $900 if it's single. We see various inflation adjustments across the board, ranging from the amount you can gift, which is going up. 2023, you can give $17,000. Next year, you can give $18,000. So there's a whole variety of things that, including tables, for example, the income range, the brackets, all of that gets adjusted each and every year for inflation.
Yeah, and it certainly does help take away some of the pinch, especially the brackets. You know, the higher the income level, it gets adjusted for those bracket amounts and how much gets tagged.
I saw also something about 1099-K filing requirements. I recall 1099-K is something about electronic payments, but I don't remember exactly what that is. Explain to me what this is all about.
Yeah, 1099-K, it really is intended to capture a little bit of the electronic commerce transactions that go on, selling on eBay, PayPal transactions, various forms of payment, where it is used as a form of commerce, but ultimately you know, without any kind of reporting that might go unchecked. So the point of 1099-K is to report payments. This would be true of credit card transactions as well. What the IRS originally proposed was a $20,000 amount, and then in this year they were intending to reduce it down to the amount that normally would be the threshold for any 1099 filing, and that's $600.
And it's a big jump.
It certainly is. And fortunately, you know, the IRS recently issued some guidance indicating that they were going to phase that in to give everyone a chance to get their record keeping in order and understand the complexities of the compliance with that. So the next year, the threshold amount will be $5,000 rather than $600.
And this encompasses a lot. So think not only online marketplaces, think concert sites, auction sites, real estate sites. There's a whole variety of ways people use online marketplaces that when they hit this threshold, 1099-K will kick in.
Now, wait a minute. If I make an online purchase at, say, Amazon, the tax is already taken out. I'm missing
well,
something
your
here.
Your sales tax might be taken out. But ultimately, what this is intended to capture is the amount of income that any particular seller may be deriving.
So if there's an eBay seller who might be somebody who looks like just an average Joe, but they're really, this is their life. But wouldn't that be income? Wouldn't that be income?
Of course it would.
But I mean, why do you need a 1099-K if you're declaring all this?
No, if you're declaring all of it, not a problem. That's really the point. Is to match up what sellers or collectors of income are reporting to these actual information documents.
I imagine compliance has been a very tough thing to police on some of these PayPal and everything else.
Yes.
Do they really expect that raising the threshold to $20,000 is going to claw back some of that money?
I don't know that it'll claw back the money, but it certainly will make the compliance easier. And it really does then focus the energy around people who are engaged in a lot of transactions, right? By making that threshold at $20,000, you're really focusing on the major sellers that are using those platforms in order to generate income.
But if someone uses Venmo or PayPal to give, let's say, their college kid some money, that doesn't count, right? The college, really?
Well,
you got to be careful. So there's a little box to check that says personal, and that's where this can go awry, is that if people don't check that appropriate box, they get to the end of the year and they get a 1099-K. It's like, well, wait a minute. I transferred that to the person I went to dinner with or went on vacation with. All of a sudden, what the heck do you do with your individual tax reporting when you get a 1099-K in the mail?
This is all very complicated, and I know it's your livelihood, but would a flat tax be better?
Well, there's varying schools of thought on that. You know, a flat tax might take away some of the impetus to perhaps play games with deductions or worry about, you know, various, pet projects being deductions. But very often, tax legislation is utilized as a means to drive not only just tax revenue, but a social agenda or an economic agenda. When I think of what's good tax policy, if we think about the bonus depreciation, for example, it's an opportunity for businesses to buy equipment and fully deduct that amount in year one rather than using that deduction over several years. So really what that was intended to do was to spur more economic growth in sales. So it's really a matter of whether or not, you know, how much we value our current system of taxation.
All right, so I'll put you both down as a no on the flat tax. So Judy Cahey is here, Don Doherty is here from BST, an accounting tax and financial services consulting firm. Let's go do a couple of emails before the break here, and then we'll go to the phones and some more of the email bag. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Paul in Massachusetts writes, if I take a capital gains loss from a stock in 2023, can I use that loss to offset a capital gain on the sale of an investment property in 2024, or must they both occur in the same year?
So there's a netting that happens in the same year, and to the extent you exceed that, so you can take up to generally a $3,000 capital loss. So for example, if he had a loss in 2023, it was $3,000, he could take that. The rest carries forward until your death. So to the extent you generate future capital gains from the sale of investment property, it would be on the shelf and be netted at that point. But normally it's an annual measurement and then it carry forward to the extent you exceed the loss amount of $3,000.
Anything to add to that, Don?
Nope.
Okay, this is from Frank. I'm wondering if you have any advice on how to structure a handyman business I'm in the early stages of beginning. I work alone, not sure if I'd be better off as a sole proprietor or an LLC in terms of limiting the income taxes I'll have to pay as well as limiting my liability since I do work in people's homes and don't want to put my personal assets and my wife's personal assets at risk. I plan to purchase liability insurance, so mainly I'm wondering how to pay as little income tax as possible. Smiley face. And that's from Frank.
Yeah, understood. And that's a really good question, especially for a startup business. Having an LLC and operating under the LLC and having all of your contracts under the LLC, including your insurance and putting yourself out there as an LLC, certainly would provide that level of limit the liability and provide that protection from the reach to personal assets. But it will not change if you're a single member LLC. That will not change the way that you're taxed. It still would appear on a Schedule C on an individual income tax return, and the net income then would be subject to both income tax and self-employment tax. So whether operating as a sole proprietor and inside an LLC, you get the same result.
Uh-huh. Assuming it's a single member LLC owned by him.
Correct.
All right, let's take a break right now. Judy Cahy and Don Daugherty are here from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. We have just begun. You got a question about taxes? 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's Tax Tips today with Don Daugherty and Judy Cahy from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Two more quick emails, and then to the phones we will go. And by the way, the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This one's from Matt. I'll be turning 72 in a couple of weeks. Can you tell me what I have to do to meet the MRD? And the MRD is minimum required distribution. Is that right?
Well, normally it's RMD. It's either
way.
Okay,
well, he says MRD. Yeah. How do I know what percentage to take out? I reinvest mostly everything in my IRA. Does that mean I need to sell off some of the stocks to get the correct amount? And how would I have the taxes taken out at the time of withdrawal? When's it due? A lot of questions there from Matt.
So the first thing Matt needs to take a look at is Secure 2.0. So we had some legislation not too long ago that increased the age you start having to take your required minimum distributions. So starting in 2023, it's age 73, and it's on its way up to 75 in 2033. So take a look at Secure 2.0 because that could impact when you think you need to start taking your required minimum distributions because it bumped up the age. That being said, you know, as a taxpayer, you know, generally your retirement distributions out of your 401ks and whatnot and IRAs are taxable to you. You have to plan accordingly for your taxes. Now, you can do that one of two ways. You know, you need to project your tax income. You can pay quarterly estimates, or you can simplify your life a little bit by matching the cash flow to and have basically federal tax withholdings taken out on that money by the payee, so that you don't have to try to make quarterly estimates, particularly if you only take that income once a year. So there's multiple ways to do that. You really need to make sure you're paying in the right amount. I mean, in concept, when we pay taxes, you need to pay either based upon the prior year or the current year at statutory percentages. So if you go into that situation, you need to be talking to your tax preparer about withholdings and whatnot.
Right. And the other neat thing about required minimum distributions that some taxpayers might choose to do is, instead of actually taking a cash distribution, instead making a charitable contribution right out of their retirement account. So you both satisfy your RMD as well as perhaps obtaining the benefit of a charitable contribution. So something for those who are in that category to think about. And it really is based on the balance that's in that account and your life expectancy, something no one really likes to think about.
But how can you predict that? You're going to get hit by a bread truck outside.
Well, let's hope that's not the case. But generally speaking, it's gone off of the IRS tables to determine what your required minimum distribution is going to be.
Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty are here from BST. And before we get to the next email and then the phones, did I read something recently, or did I imagine this, that the underpayment and overpayment penalties are going up? In other words, if you estimate and you get it wrong, or am I wrong? Did I make that out of whole cloth?
No, every month the IRS issues a guidance on what those statutory percentages are. And absolutely, in an environment where interest rates are going up, those rates go up too. But
yeah,
they're basically set on a monthly basis, and they are going up.
All right, this email from Lisa, and then we'll hit the phones, 800-348-2551. Simple question from Lisa, maybe not a simple answer. Is there any way to mitigate traditional IRA tax liabilities?
I'm not sure what's meant by traditional IRA tax liabilities. I mean, most of the time, traditional IRAs are tax deferred when you're putting into the IRA fund. It's when it comes out. I presume that's what they are referring to. And there's really not much you can do other than perhaps, you know, employ other means of deductions, bunching up your deductions at the right time when you are receiving distributions from that IRA. Again, with traditional IRA, you're not paying a tax as it goes in. You're going to pay tax when it comes out. With the Roth, it's the opposite. You're paying tax on the dollars when they go in, and it earns tax-free during the course of the Roth lifetime until such time that you take those distributions.
Yeah, the other thing, you know, fact-dependent, the other thing to consider if the money isn't needed is there's a rule that allows what's called a qualified charitable distribution. So we see that with people where they take, rather than taking a required minimum distribution out of their IRA because they have to, you can direct, in 2024, the number will be $105,000 of your what you need to take out for your distribution to a charity and not have to pay the income tax on it because you send it to a specific qualified charity.
Right? All right, help me out here, understanding something very basic. Aside from the general goodness of giving to charity, which is a wonderful thing, and I would love everyone to do that, but from a personal standpoint, if I have X dollars and I am trying to shield my tax liability, and then I give X, Y dollars to a charity, I'm still out the X, Y dollars, right? What's the difference?
So it's a little bit more beneficial. So in talking about people who we talk about itemized deductions and do they claim them, it's a little bit more beneficial when you're in a situation where you're old enough to be 72 or 73, the required minimum distribution age, and have to take that. And if you're philanthropic and want to give money, it's more beneficial generally to take and send it to the charity via this qualified charitable distribution
directly,
rather than run it mathematically through your return as an itemized deduction.
Correct.
You get a bigger bang for your buck by not including it in your income, because other things in your return are dependent on your overall adjusted gross income.
Now I understand.
So it can influence your medical and other things that you deduct that are AGI
related.
That's why you're professionals. You see, I understand. Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty are here. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. And we begin in Argyle, a person we haven't heard in some weeks. Merle, you're on. Go ahead.
All right. Hi, guys. I'm busy on Thursdays now doing charity work, so I'm it's a little hard sometimes to get through the phone. All right. The question is, we want a settlement against an insurance company, and we're the trustees of the trust, and the person that won the settlement can't get money. So his money goes into a trust fund. All right. But we are in control of his money. Is that taxable?
Well, it really depends.
Whatever we get.
Yeah. It really depends. What is the nature of the insurance settlement? What was it related to?
A stabbing. He was
so
in a
personal
group
injury,
and he got stabbed.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
It was more than just that. It was also the fact they weren't responsible. People in charge weren't responsible.
Gotcha. We understand.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well.
Okay. They didn't do their job.
Got it. Okay. Understood. So the point
so
here.
So I don't know what it was for.
All right. Let's,
personal injury or.
All right.
Income.
Well, let Dawn have a crack at this, Merle.
Well, that does make a difference. Right. How it was classified in the settlement, in the legal agreement. You have to go back to the legal agreement and determine, was it for personal injury or was it for punitive purposes? So the idea here is, if it was in fact
punitive is to
basically punish. That's really what that means. It's to
I think that's what this is for.
Okay, well,
I think that's what we want on.
Okay.
Well, legal document controls here, so
correct,
it's really important to confirm that, because the type of settlement can determines whether or not it's taxable or not.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. So what should Merle do now?
He should really return to the legal document where that settlement was agreed to and read the terms of it to understand what the nature of that settlement was.
Maybe get a lawyer involved, yeah?
I don't know if there's an accountant involved.
Well, we have several lawyers.
Okay. They'll be able to tell you what the nature of that was.
Right.
And that will drive whether or not
they
it's taxable.
They probably will also tell me whether it's taxable.
Correct.
Correct. Hey, Merle, have a happy holiday, my friend. Thank you for calling. 800-348-2551 is the number. Tax tips today with Dawn Daugherty and Judy Cahey from BST. JJ's in New Paltz. JJ.
Happy holiday, Ray, and your guests.
To you as well.
Thank you. Same to you.
Great topic and timing as usual. A quick question on spousal IRAs.
Okay.
Is a Roth IRA overpayment of a spousal IRA? I understand there's a flat 6% penalty. Is that 6% penalty only on the overpayment of deposits, or is the earnings, the interest that has been earned over the years, also penalized?
Can you tell me a little bit more? So it's not when did the excess contribution occur?
Right. That long
That's
ago, huh?
Me. the last 8 years.
So it's really a 6% excise tax.
Right.
And it's based upon the income earned, right? It's going to apply on the excess contribution plus the income earned, I believe.
Yes, I would agree with that, Judy.
Oi, not just the
yeah.
Deposit,
oi is right.
Oh boy. All right, JJ.
I want a second opinion.
You had two opinions,
yes.
But I guess we could try to find a third guest very quickly. Hey, JJ, good luck with that. We appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Tax tips today with Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty, and we go to South Hadley. Sandra. Sandra, you're on.
Hello. My question is, I'm looking at a qualified longevity annuity contract. I'm 71. I enjoy working per diem, but when I have to take my RMD, and if I keep working, it'll probably put me in another tax bracket. So I'm looking to reduce the RMD.
Okay. This one, I haven't encountered a lot of these.
Well, maybe you stumped the band here,
yeah.
Sandra.
Right. Yeah. This is a little bit. I'm just trying to get my feet under me.
Yeah,
it
me
seems
too.
Like it's a deferred fixed annuity contract that you're purchasing with your IRA money. Yeah, I don't have a lot of knowledge of this topic to be able
okay.
to help you with
the
specifics on it.
How would we find
okay.
out?
But there's lots of information. I would presume if you have access to the web. You can go right to the search box at irs.gov and search for your QLAC and see if you can find some information. We don't want to give you bad advice here.
Yeah, no.
Good point.
Right. Just another quick question.
Sure.
Can I roll? So I rolled over my 403B into a traditional IRA,
mm-hmm.
and I'm confused. Can I roll money from that into a Roth, and am I still limited?
So
to
it's
the amount?
I was
reading online you could roll over whatever you wanted, but I don't know if I'm misunderstanding.
Well, you have the ability to, but it comes generally with a tax consequence.
Yes,
so,
sure.
Yes.
So you got to do the math on a variety of different areas, including age and balance and taxes owed, and do you have cash out of pocket to fund the taxes owed on the conversion? So there's calculators to that to determine whether or not that's beneficial for you.
But you're not limited into the amount you can roll over to
Well,
a
it
Roth,
comes with a tax
know.
Consequence because what you do
right.
is
right.
you convert
right.
tax deferred dollars to a Roth. And at the point you
right.
time you do that, you create tax income for the amount you're converting, right? So that the future, basically the deal with a Roth is that the future distributions come out tax-free as long as they're for retirement. So
right.
at the...
But I mean...
Yeah.
I'm just confused because you're limited to how much you can just... Put into
in.
A Roth
that's correct.
By a deposit
yep.
by what you're earning.
That's right.
So this is different when you're rolling it over.
It
okay.
is different. And, you know, there's this
okay.
concept that's been around for a long time, called a backdoor Roth, where individuals
right, right,
who are
right.
above that threshold will instead
right.
contribute to a traditional IRA and then convert to a mm-hmm. Roth. So it is still a way to perhaps maximize what you're attempting to do. I know there have been proposals,
right.
For this to be this methodology to be shut down. Hasn't happened
right.
yet. So I think that's what you were attempting to get to. Hopefully, I'm not putting words
no,
in
yeah,
your mouth.
Yeah, it was.
Excellent.
All right. Well,
but
Sandra,
can you still?
Go ahead.
Can you? No, go ahead.
No,
I'm
you
sorry.
Go. No.
Can you still deposit the limit of what you're working on top of that?
I'm not sure what you mean. Are you referring
to
also?
You can deposit like up to, mm-hmm. like you can deposit up to $8,000, I think, if you make that much money.
Yeah, the current into a Roth. Yeah, your limits this year. We're talking 2024 or 2023.
24.
For 24, let's see. As long as your AGI is below the caps, you should be okay to
mm-hmm.
make your Roth contribution. Generally
okay.
speaking, your IRA contribution limit for 2024. Is $7,000 if you're under age 50. Age 50 and older, it's $8,000 for 2024.
And
your income limit, your AGI, is below $146,000 for a single or head of household individual, or below $230,000 if you're married filing joint.
Sandra, thanks a lot for the call. We'll do one quick email here, then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back for more with Judy Cahey and Don Daugherty. This email from Rebecca, who says, this is somewhat tax-related. Do you know if contributions to 403B counts toward my total income for Affordable Care Act Obamacare rates? It seems like the system records my adjusted gross income after 403B contributions, but maybe using my gross income. And that's from Rebecca.
Oh, that's... We're talking about income limits for purposes of buying a healthcare plan mm-hmm. on the marketplace. So that formula, I would have to look that one up in order to help Rebecca with
All
that
right.
one.
All right, so we'll leave it there for now. Roberto, the engineer, let's hit some music. We'll take a break. 800-348-2551, our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Judy Cahey and Don Daugherty are here. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's taxes today. Tax tips with Don Daugherty and Judy Cahey from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Couple emails here at voxpop@wamc.org, and then we'll jump back to our phone lines. This one's from Jay. With incentives that are tax credits for solar, heat pumps, etc., you need to owe taxes at least equal to the credits to get the credits, right? Can you use the credits in another year if your taxes don't equal the credits?
So these rules are totally changed in 2023.
Yes, they are.
We had an Inflation Reduction Act passed in 2022 that kicks in 2023. So I'm going to be a little bit rusty here on this. But they've expanded a lot in the way of doing this. Now, historically, there was no, what you measured on your return was applied against that year's tax. And I'm just trying to read here. For example, on the home energy stuff, it looking like the credit is not refundable. So, for example, the home energy efficient is non-refundable. So you can't get back more credit than you owe in taxes. I do mm-hmm. not believe, but like I said, I'm a little rusty on this because it's we're seeing it coming
we're
into
just
play,
coming.
you know, now. So,
yeah. All right, this is from Peter. Or Pete, as it is, in Gilderland, who says, I'm retired. My wife still works. Insert happy face here, says Pete. So last year, I did our joint return and ended up with a federal tax liability of $1,000 or so. So I spent $7,000 to open an end-of-year IRA to end up getting a tax refund. Is that generally a good strategy?
Well, anytime you can fund your future retirement and get a tax deduction in the process, nothing wrong with that.
No, the only consideration is the math to say, would it be better not to take a deduction and have a Roth, right? What's
your
life expectancy? What are the earnings going to be? Is mm-hmm. your income, is the one working spouse's income below the Roth limit? Because time value of money can work, but there's a calculation.
Okay, this is from Ed. Is there a minimum or maximum amount of charitable contribution I can make directly from my IRA? I hate paying taxes on the withdrawal, then not getting to deduct the contribution. I'm over 65, but less than 72.
So that's the qualified charitable distribution yep. that I mentioned earlier, where instead of taking your RMD, you can just say to your trustee, pay it directly to a qualified charity. There's rules to it. So I just had the number up
I
to
think
me.
It was 100,000, right. I believe. So in QCDs?
Yes. For 2023, that's mm-hmm. our limit. Okay. I know it changes and
yes,
it's set to
it
change
does.
in 2024. Just trying to grab it because I think.
Let me see if I have that handy, Judy.
Yeah, by the way, if you can't see this on the radio, but Dawn and Judy brought not only laptops, but stacks of papers and books. I mean, this is very impressive.
Well, we get asked some very granular questions. I believe that it's 100,000 in 2024, index for inflation to 105. I'm just trying to find at my fingertips 2023 here real fast, although they didn't specify what year.
Okay. No. Nope. Definitely not. Well, we can...
I'm going to say 100 grand.
Okay. Fair enough. This is from Peg, and then we're going to go back to the phones for now at 800-348-2551. Our friend Peg writes, subject heading, purchasing a house with IRA funds. I want to buy a house with cash from IRA. I'm 72. Is there a good or better way to do it? And that's from Peg.
So...
She's taking the entirety of her IRA out?
Yeah.
It's an email, so I can't answer that question.
So just to bring it bigger picture, right? Taking your IRA dollars out comes generally with a tax consequence. So, you know, you'd have to say, okay, I'm doing this, but P.S., I'm going to pay X dollars in federal and state taxes associated with doing that to finance the house. That could be very punitive. I mean, we don't have a lot of facts here. We don't know dollar amount. We don't know how significant the tax would be on it. But that could be punitive.
Now, for a first-time home buyer, if that is the situation, there is an exemption from your IRA. You may not include up to $10,000 of taxable income if you're a first-time home buyer.
Okay.
So there is just a little bit of a benefit, but most homes are far beyond that that amount.
So you said state and income and federal income taxes on IRA when it's time to start cashing in this thing and using it to distributions. If I'm in a high-tax state my entire working career, and got an IRA, and then when it's just about time to start distributing that, if I move to a state with no income tax, do I still have to pay the income tax from the state where I earned it all?
Generally not.
No.
But you got to be careful, right? You got to be careful to make sure that...
asking for a friend.
Right. if you maintain a house in New York or whatever state that it is that you leave, right, you have to be careful on rules and domicile and number of days spent. And really make sure that your teddy bear moves to the state with the lower taxes. So there's rules around changing your residency. But the short answer to your question is... No tax, potentially,
like
if you
this.
Structure it right.
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell my friend, and my friend's going to be very happy. Let's go back to the phones. David and Saugerties. David, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for doing this program, as most of your programs are very interesting. My question is pertaining to something that I've heard referred to as the Augusta Rule, by which an individual can rent out their home to their business or to a business for up to 14 days at no tax consequence. I don't know if I understand it correctly, but it seems like there must be more to it than just that. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there's a particular code section, 280 Cap A, subparagraph G, and that is that is the rule that effectively provides for an exemption if, in fact, you are renting out your personal residence for a minimum number of days, for no more than 14 days. And it is in the statute. So there is an exemption for that amount. So what that ultimately means, though, is you don't have the ability then, if you're itemizing your deductions, you still have to consider the fact that you received cash in hand, even though you don't have to include it in your taxable income, consider whether or not you would have the same amount of itemized deductions if you didn't actually pay all of those expenses with your own money relating to those relating to that house.
David.
So the income from that against the itemized deductions, is that?
Yeah, effectively, if you're itemizing your deductions and you are deducting your real estate taxes or you're deducting your mortgage interest, of course, that is capped under the current itemized deductions. You would want to consider whether or not that income is, in fact, paying toward those real estate taxes, therefore reducing your deduction potentially for that not taxed income.
All right, David.
And is it something that would be considered a red flag kind of thing, opening one up for scrutiny?
No, not necessarily. As long as it is fully disclosed, that is really the best. The best defense is a good offense here, and that is you fully disclose that you received the amount and it's not includable under that particular code section. But if you're using an income tax preparer, I'm sure they can help you navigate that.
All right. Well, thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Let's go to Whitestown. And Richard, you're on.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Very helpful service. I had a question here about basis. I have a house that's been sitting here for a couple of years, and we've been rehabbing it. And I was wondering what would be deductible towards a basis, tax basis. I'll list a few here. There's the tax, house tax, the electric, heating. I have Wi-Fi security cameras, mm-hmm. snow plowing.
So
house insurance,
how, mm-hmm.
and the last one is my daughter's one who's doing all this rehab,
okay.
And we paid for her when she came from Buffalo. We were paying for her hotel.
I see.
So that's a little bit out there, but I was just wondering.
So you're flipping a house? Is that what I'm gathering?
Yeah, well,
here?
No, it's actually my sister passed away and.
I see.
I inherited the house and
okay.
rehabbed it to sell.
So you're making improvements in it in order for resale.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say I was a co-owner.
I see. Okay.
So it sounds to me, so you're the co-owner of it. So it sounds to me like you have basically this home you inherited, right? So if you inherit
yes, half of it.
Sorry. So starting with basis, if you inherit a home and that person died with it and didn't pass it to you before their death, generally your basis would start with what's the fair market value on the date of death. From there, you would look to the capital improvements you did, so what you fixed up. Generally, when you own a home like that, you wouldn't count your electric bill or, you know, if you owned a second home, you would look to whether or not you could claim the property taxes on your itemized deductions yourself or... But in general, it would be more the nature of the improvements you did to fix up the house and renovate it on top of the date of death value of the home.
All right, Richard.
Right. These other expenses, like the tax, for example, there's nobody living there, but they only were incurred because, you know, we had to maintain it while we were fixing it up.
Right, but on that house to you basically is
an
almost
investment.
An investment property.
Correct.
At this point, even though you own 50% of it and don't live there. So you would have to look to the rules on your personal return to say, okay, can I claim that in my itemized if I do an itemized? And obviously with the tax rules as they are now on your federal return, that limit could be $10,000. State no limit on the property taxes, but that the appropriateness of that deduction probably would have been on your own return in your itemized deduction consideration.
All right. Hey, Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty here join us from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. And do you have a...
No.
No? Okay. I see some gesticulations. Peter in Albany. Peter, you're on.
Hello. You started talking about state tax. This may not have an answer specifically, but looking at a property in South Carolina where the property tax is going to be extremely, almost three times as much in this particular part of South Carolina for a non-resident.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking if it becomes a second home, I'll become a resident and still have a home here. But I'm a state retiree, and I'm not paying my state income tax on my pension where there I will be. So there's no answer, but is there any way to resolve what's the best way to do it or just do the numbers?
Are you wanting to move there permanently and make that? Are you intending that that's going to be your residence?
We probably keep both houses, and so it probably doesn't matter which. We probably only decide which would be our residence based on whatever's the best
The New York State is not going to like that answer.
No.
So they have a 107-page non-resident audit guideline that, so here's the trick. If you maintain a house here, they have a number of factors, and it's facts and circumstances, which house is valued more, where's your teddy bear, you know, where's your family, do you own a business? There's a variety of facts that they consider, and I'm not kidding, it's a 107-page audit guide.
Wow.
So you have to be careful. It's not only a matter of, okay, I stay out in New York State 183 days with a property here, but you have to be careful that it's truly your intent to change your life, change your doctors, change your place of worship, whatever, to change your life to there. And there's rules around that. You have to be careful. Otherwise, right, they can continue to tax all your income.
Hmm. Surprise. Peter.
Oh, I see. So New York State kind of wants you to, it's harder to not be, it's harder to give up your residency.
Correct.
In New York State if you live here than to claim it.
Yeah, and you have to prove you abandoned your residency here. You abandoned what they call domicile. So you have to show what you did by your actions to say you're no longer domiciled here, because if they deem you to be domiciled here, they have the ability to tax all of your income still with the maintenance of a residence here. Mm. So there's planning to be done there.
All right, Peter, thanks a lot for the call. This is from Kevin in Greenfield. I'm 55. I have several hundred thousand dollars in a 401k. I'm probably 3 years from retirement. Should I change it to a Roth?
So I think, again, this is similar to a question we had earlier. Consideration of whether or not you should convert an IRA to a Roth is, do you have the outside funds to pay the tax from that, right? What's the hit on your money if you don't?
And really, what tax bracket do you think you'll be in retirement compared to where you are today? Because remember, once you convert, then your income coming out of that Roth, it won't be subject to tax on the way out. You're paying it.
Yeah.
You're essentially fronting it now.
Right.
So you really need to do the math on it and make sure that makes sense, even if, you know, you might have just that amount in your IRA. If you have some other source of income that's going to, push you into a higher bracket, perhaps it makes sense to make that conversion now.
Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty join us from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. All right, we only have about 2.5 minutes here.
Oh,
so it's ladies' choice. Okay, we're going to go to line three. Scott in New Lisbon. Scott, you're on.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Listen, I've got a hypothetical. Say I'm doing really well and I'm feeling generous and I want to give my brother, who's a good guy, a $100,000 gift. You know, does he have to pay income tax on that? Or is there a number above which you do and a number below which you don't? What are the rules on that?
Here's the beautiful part of a gift, Scott. Your brother, who will be the benefactor of your generosity, will not have to pay income tax on the gift. Now, if you're above the gift exemption, which is currently $17,000, then you would be required, as the person giving the gift, to file a gift tax return. That doesn't mean that you need to pay tax on your generosity, because there is a very large exemption amount currently. That's about $12.9 million.
Oh, okay.
So unless you've used up all of your $12.9 million gift and estate exemption, then there shouldn't be a tax impact to you either. The idea though is to report it and to track it and to keep that in your records.
You have to file Form 709 and show the IRS you made a gift over $17,000.
Okay, but hang on a minute. Now, if you give something that is over $17,000, you have to file a form. But you don't have to pay taxes.
Not necessarily.
Unless it's $12 million. Fill out the form until it's $12 million?
How else will the government track how much of your $12 million you've already used up? You only get that bucket of money.
Oh, I see.
You
That's
chip
a lifetime.
Away at it.
So it counts as gifts during your life and then against your estate and death. What's left?
Correct.
Scott, you got $12
million? Just, I wish. One follow-up question. Say my brother wants to pass along some of the money to his two sons, my nephews. Same mm-hmm. deal?
Yes. Same deal. Right. And it's $17,000 per donee. So it's, you know, if it's one nephew and then another nephew, 17, 17. If you're married filing joint, you can gift split. So the couple can gift $34,000.
Nice. All right, we're done here. This was fun.
This was fun.
Judy Cahey, how do people find BST online?
BSTCO.com.
Well, great job. Dawn and Judy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll see you, I guess we'll see you right around tax filing time too, yeah?
Sounds like fun.
Support comes from John Keel Music, offering school band and orchestra rentals with school delivery to upstate New York and western New England, johnkeelmusic.com. And Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students start college after 10th or 11th grade. Applications open now for spring 2024, simons-rock.edu. Thanks again to Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty of BST Financial for joining us today. Thanks to all of you for calling in. I apologize if we didn't get to your calls. Thanks to Roberto Chacon, who is our engineer. Fine job, sir. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, oh my heavens, it's Food Friday, and we get ready for sensible, healthy, tasty holiday eating with our pal, Nicole Rodriguez. We'll see you too.